This is the Film Programme podcast from BBC Radio 4. Stick around after the show for extra news and reviews exclusive to the podcast.
Hello. Today we reveal the secrets of the score for The Shining and hear from the man who put the music to the images. But first, Yuli, an exuberant biopic of the Cuban ballet dancer Carlos Acosta. Now 45, Carlos was born the youngest of 11 children into a working-class family in Havana and encouraged to dance by his explosive father, a truck driver who considered his young son, whom he nicknamed Yuli, to be descended from Ogun, an African god and fighter. The film has been directed by award-winning Spanish director and actress Ithia Bolaín and written by Paul Laverty, most famous for working with Ken Loach. His screenplays include the marvellous Carla's Song, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, and I, Daniel Blake. When I met them, Paul explained some of the challenges of writing this particular script.
I think sometimes biopics can be very deceiving, because even when you have a fascinating life, it's trying to frame it really, because one fascinating incident after another, and it can be very flat and you run out of steam. And I think cinema, you've only got 2 hours roughly, so you're hungry for relationships. So that's one thing. And also, it's just how to focus in and the time framework and how to do that becomes a really, really big question. I didn't realise how tricky it was until we actually tried it. In fact, when we met Carlos, I said, well, I don't know if we'll be able to do this, because I've only done a fictional piece, fictional characters before, or characters long dead, and Carlos is very much alive and kicking. But so when we went to Cuba and we saw these absolutely star dancers, and we saw Carlos rehearse, and he's in his mid-40s now but still working very, very hard, there were these jewels before us, make dance part of a narrative. It's one thing to do that in a piece of paper and a script, but to actually deliver it, which I think Ithia did brilliantly with her collaborators and her choreography, we might talk about that, is quite something else. So it was a gamble, because you just didn't know if it would make the leap from paper, you know, into celluloid, you know, but I think we got away with it. Really.
You certainly did. Yeah. Often biopics of great artists can be quite inert because the moment of inspiration is impossible to show. Yeah. But with a dancer, of course, you can see all at every level. You can see them creating that moment for themselves, for other people, getting better, stronger within themselves. It's all in front of you.
And I think that's right. And the beautiful thing about dance is, it could be very, very suggestive. You know, you can capture contradiction in it. And right at the heart of the story is the massive contradiction of Carlos with his father. Because his father, Pedro, he was a bit of a brute. He started work at the age of 9. It was before the revolution. Black people were treated with tremendous discrimination. He was kicked out of a cinema. He was a grandson to a slave. It was that close. We forget sometimes 1 million people, you know, from Africa were transported in slavery to Cuba to fund the sugar plantations, and we traditionally think it was only the Spanish, but of course Britain in 1762 occupied Havana for a year, and British colonists brought in thousands of more slaves. But he wanted his son to be the best dancer in the world, you know, so to capture that contradiction, you know, and dialogue and in traditional narrative is one thing, but to try and capture that in dance was a marvellous challenge for us.
You cast in the role of the father, Santiago Alfonso, who is actually a dancer.
Yeah, he's a dancer and a choreographer. He ran the Ballet Tropicana, which was a company of like 80 dancers for 20 years. It was the jewel of the revolution, the Cabaret Tropicana. And the thing is, even though it's a very mixed-race society, we couldn't find black actors to play the role because there are so few. So there is not one film in Cuba played by a couple of black actors, they told me. And we did find this, that we couldn't find them. So we opened up the casting, we tried to find someone with presence, with charisma. And then Santiago Alfonso came, and he's an amazing, I mean, he's an institution in Cuba.
He's a great storyteller too, and told us marvellous stories of what it was like with the mafia in Havana, you know, before the revolution. He knew these people, you know, because he was just a dancer in Tropicana. And so really witty, great fun. And like many of the Cubans that we met, a great hinterland to them.
Yeah.
You know, really well educated. There was one other little thing I wonder if I could mention too, because the devil's always in the detail when you come to make a film. And it was a great grace of pleasures to make a film in Cuba, because it gives you so much. But by coincidence, all the prep and the run-up to the film happened just after the hurricane. So there was a great shortages, and because what we must never forget, of course, is that, and because it's gone on for so long, we do forget that there's been an embargo against Cuba for 60 years by the United States, coming up for 60 years this year, which is the longest embargo in recent history. It's against international law, and it's condemned every year by the United Nations General Assembly. But as apart from that, it means we couldn't get the wood. So they had to go and find the wood. It took them 3 months to do that. So they had to be picked up and laid down three times throughout the shoot. This is what I mean by collaboration. We had a brilliant art department who fought for the film and made these things possible. And so I really do take my hat off to them.
It's clear that the politics is a hugely important part of why you got involved in this at all, Paul, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And there's many, many contradictions. But hopefully it flows out of Carlos's life. Just to have thrown things in any propagandistic fashion would have totally undermined the whole project and the whole story. But Carlos's life is steeped in it. And that was another great challenge, was to have, just to see Carlos's life played out against the backdrop of what was happening in Cuba over the last 45 years. So the embargo was an enormous occasion. And then when he was a young man and he was dancing at the English National Ballet, he got very badly injured. He thought he'd have to give up. He was missing home. And what does he see in television? But the special period was when the Soviet Union collapsed. All the support for sugar just disappeared. There was malnutrition. And then it coincided with many people trying to build rafts, yeah, trying to get out of the country. And another thing during that period too, of course, was the sexual tourism. I mean, so the Cuban government won't be happy to see that. But that was a reality too.
There's that great scene outside the hotel.
Yes, yeah. And
because that's what you saw in the 90s. The people were desperate. It was the worst economic time ever. And people were doing anything to get dollars to get through. It's funny because, I mean, they obviously didn't like those scenes in Cuba when we went back with the film. We showed the film in the Karl Marx Theatre for 5,400 people. And it was an amazing reaction. And we knew they wouldn't like that. I mean, the thing all the time was, there is a celebration of Cuba in the sense of, it's a celebration of the talent, it's a celebration of a person like Carlos coming from such a poor background to get up all the way to the Royal Ballet. So there is a celebration of that, but there is also all these moments which were true, and the film wouldn't have been truthful either.
But it's within a really enormously complex structure. You've got Carlos Acosta playing himself. You have him choreographing dances that are autobiographical with his own company. Mm-hmm. You have two different actors playing him in different stages of his life. You have another dancer playing him in dances. You have flashbacks. You have people watching TV footage of the real Acosta in a fictionalised situation. You have family relationships. You've got political difficulties. Any one of those, if it was balanced too far, would wrench you out of the narrative. But somehow you managed to keep all these balls in the air. How did you do this?
I wish I could pitch like you. Well, the great excitement of something like that is to actually to do it fresh and to do it with pace and to do it with energy. So what we really wanted to do was wave Carlos's life around Cuba itself.
All the things you said, that how you juggle all these balls in the air, I think I just wanted to say that a lot of it was a bet. I mean, it was a bet on the page, and then it was a bet for me to actually put it up on the screen. So we really didn't know if it was going to go all flat or it was going to work. I remember the BBC funders, they participated in the film, asking me, well, how is this going to look? And I said, I don't know. I have to work very, very hard. This is going to be lots of work. But I really don't know. And endless discussions about, for example, you have the real Carlos on screen, and then you go flashback to a middle dancer in his 20s, which is not very much alike. And then you go into the page where you see the photographs of Carlos. So the father is watching the photographs with the real Carlos, but then is discussing with his son, which is a dancer. Then you have the other. I mean, all these things were bets. So it's like
it's a layering of realities. In the notes, Paul, I note that you said something like, I wrote this as a challenge to Ithia.
We were very, very keen that the dance would be part of the narrative and have all those suggestions that you wanted. So it was great to suggest exactly things like that. Fame or loneliness. How do you dance that we call it the Wednesday feeling? You know, when a kid is supposed to be visited by his parents in boarding school, but they never turn up when all others do. And that's the beautiful thing about dance. You just suggest these things. But then, so it was very easy in the script, but a fear, well, she'll tell you about working with Maria, the choreographer.
Paul describes it in the page, then Maria makes it in movement, and then I was there directing as well, because, I mean, I couldn't leave her with it, because there were scenes of the film, so I had to be there. But it was like in a different language altogether. And all the time having in mind, audience have gone to the cinema to see a story in film, and you cannot lose them. You cannot suddenly go, oh my God, there we go.
what it feels like as a cinema goer is watching an incredible montage of those moments in his life. It is cinematic. Yeah. It really is. It's a wonderful moment. Is it further complicated by the fact that you are actually real life partners?
I think it makes it probably simpler. The thing is, apart from being partners, there is a collaborative process in film, not only with the writer, but with everybody else. But also, I think you have to trust each other. So I really trust Paul's scripts. I think they are very meaty. And even though sometimes you have to take out things because you can't afford it, because his imagination has gone wilder than the budget, still there is meat there. Still there is a lot to go for. And then I guess Paul trusts me, because then I have to put all that in the page, and I always feel he trusts in my decisions, in my intuition. Sometimes I change things which are in the script, which, because they don't work or they work different. He never interferes. He never says...
You don't argue about it?
No, I tell him. I always say, Paul, I think this is going to be different. And he goes, on you go. I'll see it later. I trust you. So it's fantastic.
Yeah, well, there was a huge shortfall in the budget, really, what was possible. And I think that's the beautiful thing about cinema. And the great thing about collaborating is we both get very different jobs. And I always say this with my great colleague Ken Loach too. I write and the director directs, but you meet in the middle, and your loyalty is to the film and the project. And it's pointless to try and do things that are going to sabotage or undermine someone else's way of working or sensibility. You know, so if you can't collaborate in cinema, you're really in the wrong job, or you're going to end up with a heart attack.
Did you meet on Land and Freedom?
Yes. I think it was in Barcelona's airport. I was flying from Madrid. He was flying from LA. And I remember seeing Paul. Paul then had hair, long and curly. And I remember
cruel.
He opened his mouth and started talking. And I thought, what is he talking, German? I mean, I couldn't understand a word of what Paul said with that thick Glaswegian accent. And then years later, here we are. But at the beginning, I couldn't get a word.
I don't know if she understands much more now. It was a great project, that I have to say.
It really came out of the blue, really, the idea of working together. In our first collaboration was Even the Rain. Yeah. So
we thought mixing life and mixing film might be too dangerous, too explosive, but there you go.
But then we discovered that making films is easier than making children, really. It's less challenging.
That's for sure. See, trying to get them to study for their exams now. My God. Yeah, it's much easier to do another draft, eh?
It's only up to you.
Well, please do more. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks very much. It was very generous of you.
And that was Ithia Boylan and Paul Laverty. Yuli, which is both powerful and original, is in cinemas from Friday, Certificate 12A. The opening music for The Shining, composed by Wendy Carlos and Rachel Elkind. And it's the subject of the latest edition of our series with Neil Brand, in which he looks at scores that were last-minute replacements. This time we had a rather special guest in the studio, a listener who fired us an email out of the blue that sent us into a swoon. But first, here's Neil.
After Barry Lyndon, Stanley Kubrick needs a hit. And his secretary says that she remembers him having a pile of books in his office. And as he got into a book that he might make into a film and he didn't like it, he would hurl the book at the wall. So she would hear thump and she'd know it wasn't going to be that book. And then maybe an hour or two later she'd hear thump and it wouldn't be that book. And then she knew that he picked up The Shining and it was dead quiet in the room next door. There was no thump. Now, how far Kubrick wanted to make The Shining, how far he needed to make The Shining, we don't know. But the bottom line is that he did something which was very unusual for him. And if you remember right back at the beginning of this season, we talked about 2001, where he had commissioned a score and then dumped the score in its entirety and replaced it with music of his own. In this instance, he went back to tried and trusted collaborators, in this particular case, Wendy Carlos. Kubrick said, I am making The Shining, read the book, start coming up with pieces of music, even before I begin making the film. Wendy Carlos is creating music, both electronic and orchestral. Some very fine tracks. The dies irae, the day of wrath. Literally the sound of hell, as it were. And if you cast your mind back to The Shining, that is the music, very much in the style of Wendy Carlos, that we hear over the opening credits as the car is speeding through landscapes that are growing bigger and more isolating and more horrifying towards the Overlook Hotel. Fast forward to when the film actually comes out. And I can tell you a little bit that I know, which is that basically that was the only cue of Wendy Carlos's music that ended up in the film. The man who can tell you the rest is sitting with us, and this is such a massive joy and a privilege to have somebody here who was actually involved in the process of creating this, because the music editor and the man ultimately left by Kubrick to do the job of placing the music that Kubrick decided he wanted, not Wendy Carlos's music, is Gordon Stainforth, and he's with us now.
Gordon, thank you so much for getting in touch with the programme, for coming in to talk to us about this. It really is thrilling. Tell us how you got involved in the project.
I came in very sideways. I was an assistant editor in television. I got this phone call from Elstree that Vivian Kubrick was looking for an assistant to help her edit a documentary on the making of The Shining.
This is his daughter.
His daughter, yes. And I remember there was one day, and I was really concentrating on a difficult thing. I heard these footsteps coming down the corridor, and I didn't sort of take it. Someone came into the room. Yeah, and I look up, and it is Stanley himself. And you know, with these very extraordinary eyebrows. And somehow when you saw the actual guy, he was more extraordinary and more scruffy than he looked even in the photographs, you know. And, you know, you couldn't mistake him. And then he said in this very quiet voice, he said, "Gordon, I just wanted to come and see how you're getting on." And the whole tone was sort of so pleasant and so polite. "See how you're getting on." And while he's saying this, his eyes are going all around the cutting room. He's looking at the boxes, seeing how I've labelled stuff. You know, you can sort of see him sort of soaking it all in.
And your involvement in the actual film itself had something to do with septicemia, didn't it?
Yes. Oh, that's one of those extraordinary things. So I was then literally working as one of the third assistants. Suddenly, Ray had got very run down because of Stanley's working hours and working late in the evening.
Ray's the editor.
Yes, Ray, the editor. Anyhow, over a party at Christmas, one of those old beer cans, you know, the rings, he pulled and he cut himself with one of those horrible sharp metal cap things. But this had turned very rapidly into septicemia. And straight away, Jill, the first assistant, is just automatically takes Ray's place and is working with Stanley. And Jill's brother was getting married on the Saturday. So she had to go home early on the Friday night. So I was just literally getting on my motorbike. The timing was good because I could have been sort of gone a few minutes later. He had this tannoy system. You know, he's fond of things like this, Stanley. Good communication system. So this message came over.
Down the corridors at Elstree.
No, this was at Chiddickbury, his big mansion. We were all based in his stable block. It was all very secretive at this point. Did you not know this?
No.
He had moved from Boreham Wood, Abbots Mead, which is this lovely kind of 20s type house. But he bought this huge Victorian mansion. I can digress for a bit here. Because Vivian, they had just moved in and he'd bought it, I think, during The Shining or just before, being so busy. They moved in over months, slowly, you know. They'd only just sort of arrived. And Vivian said, "I'll take you for a grand tour." And it's this vast, sort of almost Buckingham Palace scale mansion. And she took me around, she's showing me this and showing me that. We get to some little stairs around one corridor, and there's this door, and we opened it. She opened it. And it's like a hotel corridor with rooms going right off into the distance. She said, "Oh, I didn't know this wing was here."
Wow.
That's how big the house was. And
that sounds like a scene from The Shining in itself.
Yes, and
so there the editing was going on in a stable block. There.
Yes, it had this lovely old Victorian stable block, and the front had these little rooms. I don't know what they'd been used for. I suppose staff everyone involved with coaches in the coaching days, I suppose, had lived there. Yeah, and it was in the upstairs of that, and rather secretly on the back side of that was where his main cutting room was. And we were there. He'd moved out of Elstree. He didn't like working at Elstree. After the movie had finished shooting, he'd just taken the whole thing there. And, yeah, so that's...
Over the tannoy here in Stable Block, what did he say?
Yes. Yeah, it was, is Gordon still here? Because Stanley would like to him to come and cut some film. And that was from going from a nobody. And I thought, did I even hear that right? And I remember I sort of took off my motorbike stuff and I thought, this is your big moment, Gordon. Yeah, and I went into the cutting room and there's no one else there. And he came in straight away, was there, and he scarcely kind of said hello. He said, Gordon, what I'm doing here, we're cutting this scene. And he treated me exactly as if he'd known me for years and I was an experienced film editor. And then he sat down at the Steenbeck and he's marking with the China graphs he always does, and giving me quite a long set of instructions. And there's about four or five shots to be cut together. And as soon as he went out of the room, I grabbed a sheet of paper, I scribbled down what he'd said, and I was thinking, Gordon, don't rush this, but don't be too slow. You know, I remember my heart was absolutely beating, so I was thinking, you know, I've got to get this right. The very first thing, it's got to go right.
How much time did you allot yourself then for that?
I think it was about 3-4 minutes, something like that, quite fast. And then I looked at it quickly and I thought, I think that's what he meant, yeah. And I said, OK, Stanley. And he comes into the room, sits down, and he plays it. He said, OK, right, what we're doing next. Comment. And then he just, exactly the same, this matter-of-fact way of working.
But you'd pass the test?
Yes, but he didn't know, nothing was made of it. You were just doing your job, yeah. That's what I meant, yeah. On we go, yeah. I worked all the way through the Saturday. I wasn't terribly sure how well I was getting on with Stanley or not, because he wasn't being at all conversational. And then there was this sudden change at about 6:37, where he suddenly turns to me and said, Gordon, I think you're looking a bit tired and you're probably hungry. And you're suddenly like this different personality. And he said, come and eat with us. And I think that very first evening, we went across to his very grand dining room conservatory on the side of the mansion. And it was just like being at a dinner party. And it was this complete... And I was made to just feel part of the family. Totally polite again. It was just like being at a dinner party. So that was the... And I'm thinking, this is quite extraordinary because they're so nice, really.
Well, were they talking about the movie?
No. No, he wouldn't talk about... He wouldn't talk about other people's movies. He would absolutely shut up like a clam if people started to get him onto movies, and particularly trying to get him to talk about movies. He wouldn't do it. He would be talking about current affairs and general topics.
So anything but film?
Particularly anything but The Shining. Because one thing he would never do is put people down. He once made quite a rude comment about a famous film star in the past, but that was the only rude comment I can ever remember. Typically not. Typically it would just be complimentary. The only person he did several times mention was Peter Sellers.
In what capacity?
Always very complimentary. I think Stanley thought he was just wonderful, you know. So that was the impression I got. It's the only time he would come up in conversation, and it was, you know, Peter this and so. Oh, and the other one, Ken Adam, the designer who did the Strangelove set, he came up in conversation. It's only the people he really rated highly would get mentioned.
So pointedly did not like to talk shop.
No. And he didn't like being intellectual.
What do you mean by that?
Intellectual discussions about meaning, you know, and all the way people were talking in the 60s, you know, particularly the French and, you know.
Meaning, you know, in his films?
Because I'd been to film school, you know, and all that kind of intellectual talk, no. And he always did this kind of act, Kubrick, of pretending to be slightly less learned and slightly less on the ball than he was. It was his little game he'd play. And you'd see people making such fools of themselves where they would argue with him about some technical point because he knew so much technically. And I just remember it so many times, about three or four times anyway, where I'm thinking, oh, don't walk down there. Stanley's going to walk all over you.
You said he doesn't like talking about film, but did he like talking about music?
I don't remember long discussions. He just loved music and very wide, eclectic tastes. I'm pretty keen on a lot of classical, but... now, as I say, he didn't. I don't remember getting into what I would describe as an intellectual discussion about anything with him ever. Mm. And I can just digress slightly, though, because I remember one night when he was more chatty, I'd got really into this thing about Brendan the Navigator and how they used to navigate. And they talk about the stars. And he got really interested about navigating by the stars. Yeah. And he suddenly turned off the Steenbeck and he said, Gordon, let's go out and look at the stars. And so I'm standing on the gravel outside the stable block at about 11 at night. It's a really cold night with this incredible starlit sky. A perfect night in November or something. No, February, I can't remember. Getting really cold. But we're talking about the stars, and I thought this is pretty amazing. Yes. Talking about the stars with the director of 2001.
Stargazing with Kubrick.
Yeah, yeah. So I had to digress there.
So when it came to dealing with The Shining from the point of view of the music and the music work you were doing, did you start off by hearing what Wendy Carlos had sent and putting that into the film? Were you actually dubbing the film with her music?
I didn't know at all the story of the Wendy Carlos music going wrong. The way it was presented to me, that Stanley suddenly had this problem because he wasn't satisfied with the music. That's all I heard about it, that it wasn't working for him quite the way... He hadn't got quite what he felt was right for the movie. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly it was, Gordon, would you like to be the music editor? Because I want to tackle this in a completely different way. Would you like to do this? And I said, yes, Stanley. Yeah, so it was just amazing. Mm.
I've got a pet theory, which I will run by you. You can throw it out or accept it however you want. What it strikes me with Wendy Carlos's score is that, strangely enough, even though Wendy Carlos is brilliant and that range of sounds that she's working with is extraordinary, it was almost a familiar sound because of Clockwork Orange.
Yes. Yeah.
So that when Kubrick then comes to produce something completely new, and obviously he moves from one universe to another when he moves from one film to another,
yeah,
he sees Jack Nicholson getting more and more and more crazy, beautifully directed as he has done, beautifully performed by Jack. And the music's not going to that depth of utter mental chaos that he's got Jack to. That's my pet theory about why Wendy Carlos'
music...
Pretty
much exactly right, I think, yes. You see, he kept the opening thing, so it's got that nice creepy thing, but in a way it's more conventional. It's the big, lovely sound and the diazerie, and yeah, it's more what you'd expect, whereas the Penderecki is alien modern music.
So when you had to source, when Kubrick says, I think Penderecki will work here, how are you sourcing? This stuff wasn't readily available. Yeah. How did you get hold of some of the material?
What he said, exact words were, I want you to get hold of everything Penderecki's ever recorded. and he already had some records, but it came in different forms. There was certainly a whole stack of LPs. There was lots of quarter-inch tapes, and I think there was some even wider stuff. So it was absolute chaos. And I remember it was 10 days solid. I was listening to Penderecki, and he said, I want to sort of hear a shortlist, play back some of the stuff you think is going to work. So I would be playing stuff, and Stanley he'd be always very so positive, yes, no, yes, that's what I mean, yes, yes, no. Just about that level of discussion, that was it. So that's what I was then working with. And he told me all the music cues for where which scenes he wanted music. He would say, you know, Penderecki Polymorphia might work here. It was a very sort of two-way thing. And then I'd say, well, I've been listening to this sort of Utrenia, I think it was called, which is pretty good. You might like that. And I'd play, oh, yeah, go on, yeah, try that, try it, you know, very much that. But he had these music cues, to which I obeyed, except for one.
Well, this your work on Shining has been celebrated for its precision. Can you give us an example of how you took and edited a piece of music to dialogue or a moment in the film?
Some were quite easy and didn't need much cutting at all. Some, I mean, towards the end, it's just a complete mosaic where I'm literally finding bits which work here, bits which work there. And so it's a huge jigsaw puzzle.
You even overlaid Penderecki on Penderecki at times.
Yes,
didn't you?
I think I can repeat this on air, but he's saying, basically, Kubrick was saying to me, yes, you're sort of on the right tracks, that's what I mean, but it's still not strong enough. And I said, you've got to beef it up, was his exact word. You've got to beef it up, Gordon. I said, how can I? I've got the most exciting, dramatic stuff in the whole of Penderecki. I can't find anything more. And he said, oh, well, put one piece of music on top of the other. No one will notice. And I don't think they ever did. Or if they did, it wasn't talked about.
No.
Gordon, wasn't there one cue that Stanley hadn't asked for? Which one was that?
Yeah, that was Jack and Danny in the bedroom, where Danny says something like, you'll never hurt Mummy and me, will you? And he said, who said that? Was that your mother? And I always sort of liked the scene, but I thought, it's sort of empty. It's a long scene. I thought really some music here would help. And it came to me completely sideways because we'd used the Bartok already for the maze, the daytime summer maze, and it worked pretty well. And I thought, I've got a feeling the Bartok could work. The adagio part of the Bartok, which is the music for strings, percussion and celesta. Yeah, and I'm just thinking that could work. And when I first put it on, I couldn't believe how well it did work. And I thought, I'm going to have a crack at this. And the trouble is, one bit worked here well with the dialogue, another bit worked, so I had to actually cut it, I think I'm right in saying, into three bits. And I'm thinking, because I've got to use this last bit, but I've got to go from this bit here. And I saw that the way that section of music ended in the Bartok was exactly the way it happened to repeat again. I thought, well, this is going to work musically, and cut them together without anyone being offended. And it was completely worked. You know, and I just laid it. It was just one track, just with two splices in it. Nothing laid off, so no one would be any the wiser that I'd actually cut Bartok.
So what was Stanley's reaction when he walked in and heard
that? Well, what happened was, I remember how it had, and it took me all night, I remember, and I was really tired. And of course, as you're getting tired, you're getting so and so, and I thought, I've got to have this ready. And I was slightly late, and I think it was something like 9:05. Dubbing starts at 9. And I'm taking the music tracks across the theatre when his gold Mercedes comes up. He's slightly late, and he gets out of the car, and he said, Gordon, what are you doing? Why haven't you already got the tracks there? He's quite annoyed at me. You know, surely you should have got your And I looked at him, and I said, Stanley, I've been working all night on it. And he said, what doing? Why? I said, I've put some music on the... Oh, we can't... Well, let's see. Oh, we can't have music there, Gordon. And I remember I was so tired and cross. I just said, Stanley, I think you'll like it. Please listen to it. I beg you to listen to it. He said, OK. Yeah, and he really liked it. So I was very, very pleased with that. I came in as they're just starting the playback with the colour cutting copy, and it's a full... six-track stereo with a fantastic sound. The reel ended, and Stanley turned, and then he got up, and I was just standing right at the back. And I don't know how Stanley knew I was there, but it was sort of uncanny, because he's walking up the aisle, and I thought, what's he doing? Where's he going? And I suddenly realised he's coming towards me. And he came right up to about 6 feet away, and he just leant forward slightly, slightly lowered his voice, I think, and just said, "Gordon, I just wanted to tell you that was beautifully done." So that was in front of the whole Zelig Theatre.
Very good.
That must have been quite a moment.
It was.
See, that's funny because the way you describe working with him is as somebody with very, very strong ideas about what they wanted, but also open to collaboration. And that is not the received wisdom about Kubrick. Kubrick is seen as a figure of, well, quite a controlling figure. That is the received wisdom.
Yes, it's not really correct. He had this incredible way of getting the very best out of people. He got people to excel themselves. And it was often done as a challenge, you know. And there's this occasion that we called it the red bathroom scene. And in the main gold ballroom, there's the whole band playing. And then Jack and Grady go into the loo. And I thought, well, when the door shuts, the music will be almost, you know, you won't, because it's a heavy door, you won't hear much. And Stanley said, no, I want the music still going in the background. And then I think when I first played it, he said, oh, it's far too quiet, Gordon. I mean, it's true because it's just sort of irritating background sound. It's a bit louder. And then you've got this huge problem because I'm trying everything of the lyrics of the song clashing with the dialogue and of the scene with Grady and Jack. And I'm saying this is really confusing because we've got these background words going on, which is just a sort of mess. And he said, that's why it's got to be a bit louder. So it was his wonderful way of, without saying, he was setting down this challenge to me of getting that to work. And that was the most difficult bit of the editing, by far, to get the lines of the song to dovetail them in within the lines of dialogue. Jack saying, I remember you chopped up your wife and daughter into little bits. It's all forgotten now. And then at the end, he's saying, you must correct your wife. I corrected them, how he's killed her, and you must do the same, you know. And then it's, sweet dreams will take me home. And Stanley loved that.
But the real irony is that that music is intended to be light and lovely and something you dance to and something that you relax to. And here it is also almost providing the motive for mass murder, which I can immediately see how he would really respond to that. And the more sort of sentimental and Al Bowley-like it is, the more horrible that contrast becomes.
Yeah.
Tell us about his work ethic.
The thing is that he was a hard taskmaster to himself. You know, taskmaster is really the wrong word. There's this big, complicated, very expensive movie to be done. Mm. And having spent millions on it, you've got to try and do the best possible with the material. Yeah, and a refrain of Stanley's, which I heard him say several times when something went wrong, oh, so careless. You know, if someone was doing their best and really trying to make something work, it's very difficult, fine. But if he felt that someone wasn't doing their best or being sloppy, not fine. Oh, so callous.
You know, a couple of times in this conversation, you've sat there with tears in your eyes.
God, it really is extraordinary. It is quite emotional for me. I mean, the thing is, when he died, it came out, because he died younger than they were expecting. I was absolutely shocked. And I was working at my computer, on the first computer I had. And I remember I turned off the computer and I just cried and cried. And for about 2 hours. And that surprised me as how much I grieved when Stanley Kubrick died. And people saying, oh, you've softy. It's true. It's true. I thought the world has lost someone.
Gordon Stainforth, the music editor of The Shining and pianist and composer Neil Brand. You can see The Shining in the BFI South Bank during April as part of their Stanley Kubrick series. On next week's programme, how to film on the high seas, the subtle secrets of screen acting and a Yentl reunion. Papa, can you hear me?
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Caitlin Benedict, presenter of the NB podcast on BBC Sounds, joins me. And we have been watching the Italian film Happy as Lazzaro, haven't we?
We have.
What did you think?
Oh my God, it was really beautiful, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was really incredible. And I famously hate watching a film with subtitles. I thought it was really wonderful. What did you think?
Oh, it's quite literally magical because it is really a fable. It's made by the 36-year-old Italian director Alice Rohrwacher, and she made a movie before about beekeepers. I think her father was a beekeeper in real life, and she has an eye for the mystical and the mythical. And this is set in 1980s unknown province of an unspecified province of Italy, which is actually Umbria. And it's about a hamlet of about four or five houses that are attached to a country estate. Mm-hmm. And the Marchesa of the estate is a tobacco maker. And
The
cigarette queen.
She's vile.
She really is. And she is exploiting her workers. And they believe themselves to be, well, they are basically her slaves. And they don't realise that this sharecropping system was outlawed in the 70s. And this is now the 80s. And they're living as her slaves and living in these four houses overrun with as many people as they can stuff into them. And one of the people in the house is a young man, Lazzaro, who is
so kind and good that he seems simple, a sort of saint-like figure, so beautiful. They did, for the casting process for this, one of those big sweeps of all of the high school boys in the area and saw about 1,000 young men and came up with this cherubic sort of Caravaggio youth, whose name is Adriano Tardiolo. And he is so still and so beautiful, and his performance takes you through two big time periods, and he's the man out of time in the second half where he retains his youth while all the people who he grew up with have aged horribly, and it shifts from this bucolic regional setting into this really rough city setting, and all of the people who've been displaced by... Now, this is really interesting, the sharecropping thing as well, because I had no idea about it, but basically it was a sort of vaguely feudal system in which people had servants, slaves, somewhere in between the two, working on their land. And it was outlawed in the mid-20th century in Italy. But this actually really happened, that because of how isolated certain parts of central Italy were at the time, they were able to basically keep their slaves by just not telling them that the law had changed.
Oh, by the way, the law has changed.
Yeah.
And nobody came to... This is like, it's like reading about Russia after the revolution. There are some pockets of Russia where they had no idea a revolution had occurred. It's just like this. And apparently the director came across the newspaper article, The Great Swindle, it was called. Yeah. And this Marchesa was convicted of illegal trafficking, tax evasion, enslavement, racketeering and aggravated fraud. But you know something, it's interesting that this should be happening in Italy, because it does refer to, I think, tangentially to the mafia and that sort of the old systems of corruption that some people just fail to question or even imagine could be overthrown. This is just the way it is. I mean, a few years ago, I was in a region of Tuscany called Lunigiana, where they believe in werewolves and talk about gnomes and not the little plastic ones you get in gardens. There really is that sense that in the chestnut forests, goodness knows what you might meet. So there are pockets of Italy that are, that actually even today you could imagine it's not impossible. I've seen people living in caves outside towns in Sicily. I mean, it's not impossible that this could happen.
And gnome belief is at an all-time high, so the newspapers tell us.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And this is a little village called Inviolata, which translates to the untouched.
Untarnished.
Just wonderful. And there are characters in the little village, the viper, the wolf, the marchese, the grandmother, who is absolutely beyond ancient and is occasionally carried to the table, isn't she? Like a sort of little like a little wooden statue.
She's just moved around the building.
Grandma up, you know, and there she is. It's really an incredible, but there are little places like this that the director mentioned in an interview. She said she came across such a hamlet like this called The Bandit and another called The Rediscovered. There is a sense that, you know, that this could happen. But there's an amazing moment in the movie where Lazzaro sort of... You never really know who Lazzaro is. Is he a ghost? You know, is he a symbol? Is he the myth? But he walks from the country to the town and it changes season. So you're in the hot sun and then suddenly he's walking through the snow. And it's just, this is a movie as if it had been made by Ken Loach meets Angela Carter in Italy, if you can imagine that. I mean, for a start, he has a cast of largely non-professional actors who are almost living like derelicts in the end, aren't they, on the outskirts of Turin. And there is the desolation of their life is quite something.
Well, it's really amazing because it's part social satire, but then it's also got this incredible magic realism about it. And I love that Catholic story is like a mythology. The iconography of Lazzaro is like part Lazarus, part St. Francis, this kind of saint-like figure who glides through the world without really connecting with it. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, there's a lovely little moment when, because Lazzaro ends up living with the shareholders, the sharecroppers who have come to live in the outskirts of the city. And he can see even amongst the rubble the goodness. So he can say, look, that's wild nettle, we can eat that. Or look, that's white carrot, that can be boiled and eaten. So he can see amongst literally the junk, the beautiful things in the world.
And he's followed by this wolf who is a Christ figure. I don't know, I'm reading a lot into it, but I just found it so beautiful.
But what's amazing is she films this wolf, this white wolf, and it is absolute verite. I mean, this is an actual wolf, a trained wolf.
I've got some questions about this, actually, because in her very beautiful notes that she wrote about the film, she goes, you know, there are no special effects here. I'm like, did you get a wolf to run along a highway then?
It looks to me like a wolf running along a highway.
It's really amazing.
It really that is incredible.
So whoever did the wolf training on this film deserves
good wolf acting.
Some sort of prize in themselves.
And it's all been filmed in 16 mils. So she said something really interesting as well about why she chose to do that. Not just because it looks automatically beautiful and it has this wash of nostalgia and it immediately puts you into a swoon, the look of that. But because there's something about using film, particularly these days, it's expensive. You have to really think about what it is you're doing. And also you wait for the rushes. So there's a sense of pageant to it, and a sense of mystery. What might we have captured? So I think, you know, your point about the wolf is really interesting because that's a big risk to take.
Yeah.
You know, if you're actually going to be committing this to film. And that there's the shot of the wolf on the highway is unforgettable. And there's another shot that I thought was very beautiful. And it's when the people in the village are touching the face of Lazzaro. And there is a particular hand that touches his face. And the fingers of that hand have been bent completely out of any kind of what you could consider a normal human hand. Just through by dint of hard work and a difficult life. And it's just a shot that lasts a couple of seconds. But it's heartrending. This is a really properly beautiful and unusual film. At one point, the Marchese is the only person who actually teaches the children anything. They've never heard of school. They don't go to school. And she's teaching them, I think it was because I wrote down a couple of phrases that she's teaching them. She's teaching them Adam Smith, the theory of modern sentiments, you know, the great Scottish economist. It's like, you know, this woman, Alice Rohrwacher, this director, she's the real deal. I'm really excited about her and what she might do next.
Yeah. And so this is a very hearty recommendation from both of us for this film, but it's a small release and it's a year after it had all of this buzz at Cannes. I don't know anything about awards, but it feels like this should have been trumpeted a bit more loudly, right?
Well, it won Best Screenplay at Cannes. And I'm often talking to the producer of this programme about why is it that, you know, we hear a lot about movies trumpeted at Cannes, this is a wonderful thing, and then we wait at least a year or sometimes longer for them to pitch up in the cinemas. And it's a really curious thing. You do wonder how much awards affect audiences. For example, if you saw Palme d'Or screenplay winner on a poster, Caitlin, would that make you think, oh, maybe I'll see this?
Yeah, maybe now, maybe after 3 years of film-based Stockholm syndrome on this programme. I still go, oh, yes, that looks like a legitimate film. But, you know, I'm still going to go see Avengers Endgame before I go see any of these things. And that is the tragic truth of probably I am destroying the film industry, just single-handedly.
It's you.
It's me, I've done
it's
it.
It's you, you've done it.
My name is Caitlin, and I'm non-binary.
Have you come out to your family as non-binary, Caitlin?
And that's Amru. We're making a podcast about coming out and figuring ourselves out.
I still have a lot of questions.
Do you think you know what non-binary means? How did it feel? So what exactly is tucking? Some questions are bigger than others, but all of them are worth asking. You might have heard the term non-binary. This is how it feels. NB, a new podcast from BBC Sounds.